I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dara Horn, award-winning author of the new book, People Love Dead Jews, Report from a Haunted Present. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. As we move gradually from our coronavirus year and a half and continue to reopen society here in America, I've been thinking about the ways that the pandemic has changed us and wondering what we've learned. It's a complex question, and seeking those answers may seem premature. COVID-19 is still ravaging many countries. For example, Russia just closed down most businesses as their cases spike and people sicken and die. According to the latest statistics, about half the world has received at least one vaccination. That's fairly good. And many countries are higher than the United States, 66%. But the continent of Africa has only two nations above 25%, and many are below 5%. There are so many odd international anomalies with vaccination statistics. Panama and Costa Rica at over 70% vaccinated, while neighboring Nicaragua is at 10%. Cambodia is at 82%, and neighboring Laos, culturally similar, is at 42%, and so on. Still, at least here in America, things are getting back to something like a new normal. Baseball, football, and basketball stadiums are full of fans. Indoor concerts and live theaters are returning. And Shabbat services are places you go to in person once again, not just on Zoom or Facebook or whatever they change Facebook's name to. Which brings me back to the question that seems to be the most important one. What is it we've learned from all of this about how we go about our daily lives? For me, the lesson that many things we thought we had to be present for in person don't have to be that way has been helpful. Meetings, in particular, are no longer essential to attend in person. That saves travel time, gas, hassle, energy, and, you know, irritation. Boy, I don't miss all those in-person meetings even a little bit. Lectures and instructional talks that I'm not sure will be great, I'm very happy to zoom into. I can leave without offending anybody. Shopping and marketing work quite well as delivery services, perhaps better than schlepping around. Even movies are pretty darn good at home on a good-sized TV delivered from a streaming service with decent speakers, without the trouble and expense of lines and overpriced popcorn. As a rabbi, I spend a lot of energy and time on two areas of work that can be experienced either online or in person: classes and services. Classes work reasonably well on Zoom, although the majority of my courses, I now teach 5 different weekly Adult Education Academy classes on Judaism, plus Sunday mornings teaching all kinds of different Jewish subjects to young people in our religious school. Well, the majority of my classes actually seem to work better in person, to be honest. Still, there's no doubt that a well-organized, technically solid, blended or hybrid class can be effective and enjoyable to teach and to take. I'd rather have the energy and feedback of live students, of course, but we'll always be able to offer Jewish education now to everyone, everywhere, through the technology we have, which will only get better. Now, services. Well, I'm grateful to be able to offer services online and thrilled that everyone, shut-ins, people traveling, members and guests of our congregation all around the world can come to Shabbat and holiday services and get a decent broadcast. But services are so much better as a live experience, it's almost impossible to compare them. The sense of community, the energy of real live human beings, praying, singing, being together, the social camaraderie of hanging around afterwards for an Oneg Shabbat or Kiddush and kibitzing, all of that is so crucial to the Jewish experience. Look, you can talk to God anytime, anywhere. And you can turn on my service on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, and listen to any previous service for the whole last year, if you so desire, and get a feel for what actually happened or even is happening. But it's in no way the same as being there. I'm not saying God isn't present for everybody sitting in their bathrobe with Shabbat services playing in the background as they drink coffee. But folks, it ain't the same as being there and feeling the connections that make real community matter so deeply. So I guess this is my pitch to come to services in person and emerge from the pandemic with your spirits refreshed, renewed, and replenished. On the subject of, now, and to play us in this morning, here's a wonderful performance by Achinoam Nini, the Israeli singer Noah, past guest multiple times of Too Jewish, with her lovely song, Now.
Now there is light coming in through the crack in the door. Now there is hope where I'd never expected before. Now there are so many things, but there's nothing at all. Now you are learning to stand. As the air in the night becomes cooler and sweet, now I get up 7 times just to cover his feet. Now there is pain, but I've packed it away for next year. Now there is newness and grace, and for now there's no fear. Then I can hardly remember what then used to be.
That was Noah's song, Now. When we return on Too Jewish in a moment, our guest, the outstanding novelist Dara Horn, a good friend of Too Jewish, shares what motivated her to write her new nonfiction book with its provocative title, People Love Dead Jews, Report from a Haunted Present. Find out when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has grown into a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for in-person Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, for all that information. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely and in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. You can email me, rabbi at BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., and Torah study beforehand at Zoom, all with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. We will continue to have services with full music in person as well as by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format too, some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services, in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and most enjoyable Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome back a good friend of Too Jewish, Dara Horn, the outstanding novelist who has published a new book that is not a novel, called People Love Dead Jews, a nonfiction book that is taking the Jewish world by storm. Good morning and welcome back to Too Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me.
I always brag about the fact that you appreciate that we were your first radio interview, and
yes, of my very first book,
and try to have you on for every book thereafter. Really love your work. This is we were talking before we went on air about how this is a very timely book, but really it's a timeless book, right? Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, this is obviously anti-Semitism is a timeless phenomenon, unfortunately. But I think that what startles people about this book is the way I put it so bluntly. I mean, that I literally titled my book "People Love Dead Jews." You know, a lot of readers might find that title disturbing, and what I would say to those readers is if you find the title disturbing, you're going to definitely be even more disturbed by what's inside the book. And well, I'm now leaning even more on this theme. I should mention before I forget that I also have a podcast, a spinoff of this book, which is called Adventures with Dead Jews, because this topic is, in fact, far too vast for one book to contain.
That's kind of amazing, well, and terrible. You know, when I started Too Jewish 19 years ago, the idea was to talk about everything Jewish and all the vitality of Jewish life, adapting to being accepted and all of that. And yet I find myself talking about anti-Semitism and the Holocaust again and again. That's kind of one of the key themes of People Love Dead Jews.
Yes. So as you, I mean, you're a rare interviewer who has, you know, followed my work for a very long time. And so you know that my books are always about the vitality of Jewish life. In fact, my last novel was called Eternal Life, and it was about a Jewish woman who is 2,000 years old and could not die. So, you know, I spent 20 years not writing this book. I used to, when I gave public talks about my novels, I often would ask the audience, you know, how many people here can name four concentration camps? And that's often something many educated readers can do. And then I'd ask those same people, how many of those same people can name four Yiddish writers?
Right.
80% of the people who were murdered in the Holocaust were Yiddish speakers, the famously literary culture. Why do we care so much about how these people died when we do not care at all about how these people lived? I now feel that I was naive in presenting that, because what I did not appreciate and what I dive into this, in this book, is like the vast role that dead Jews play in the imagination of a non-Jewish world. And that's really what, and so in this book, I sort of am like looking into this funhouse mirror and exactly writing the book that I did not want to write for 20 years, but that I felt compelled to write now.
We will explore that in much greater detail when we come back with the outstanding novelist and nonfiction writer, Dara Horn, here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store or Podbean as podcasts. We are top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean.
Introductory Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? What do Jews believe about life after death? Introductory Judaism with Rabbi Sam Kohan is an 8-month-long weekly class, Sunday afternoons. It's available in person and on Zoom. To sign up, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. There is a charge for the class and the textbook, and scholarships are available. The Introductory Judaism class is open to everyone, Jewish or not. Want to refresh and update the Jewish learning you had before your bar mitzvah? Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Or maybe you're even thinking about becoming Jewish. Register for Introductory Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. Or you can visit BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or you can email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Introductory Judaism is taught in person and by Zoom Sunday afternoons from October to May at Congregation Beit Simcha, 2270 West Einar Road, just west of La Jolla. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Malta, a really interesting little place in the Mediterranean, set of islands, as you mentioned, a kind of small archipelago. The Jewish history there, you mentioned last week, starts with Saul, well, also known as St. Paul, visiting and converting people to Judaism and then to Christianity. But that's probably not where the Jews see their origin in Malta.
Right. That is according to Maltese sort of popular history. The accepted Maltese version of history is that Paul was the first Jew and made converts and preached in Malta. Other serious Maltese historians and archaeologists believe that the Jews came with Phoenicians when the Phoenicians first settled Malta, so that among the earliest settlers in the population
were some Jews,
who moved west across the Mediterranean with the Phoenicians. And there's also an origin story for Jews in Morocco that is similar to this. And the Phoenicians did go all the way to Spain and Morocco, yeah, and it is not...
Carthage was founded by Phoenicians, like, you know, all along.
Right. Sure. It's not unthinkable that they brought Jews with them.
Not at all.
So that's version B. Version C, which is indisputable, because there's written records, and there's sites, and there's landmarks, and there's inscriptions, and there's tombstones.
Physical evidence.
Version C is that... when Malta was eventually colonized by the Romans, which of course it was, the entire Mediterranean was a Roman lake, Jews started settling there as traders, and there were places named, there were like streets named for the Jewish silk traders, and the Jewish this trader, and the Jewish that trader. So there were obviously small Jewish communities, which may have looked bigger in such a small place. I mean, the capital of old Malta, Medina, had about 300 people. So if 30 of them were Jewish, that was a big percentage, yeah. Right? Okay. Yeah. So all through Maltese history, there are various types of evidence as to a Jewish presence. There were also times when Jews were chased out, namely when the Edict of 1492 went into effect. Malta was under the Spanish crown because it was part of Sicily, and the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies was ruled by Spain, and Jews had to either flee or go into hiding or pretend to convert or whatever, and Maltese Jews were no exception. But Maltese Jews were largely, in the Middle Ages, seen as a source of revenue by Maltese pirates who knew that if they captured Jews, particularly influential or learned Jews or wealthy Jews from ships traversing the Mediterranean, they could hold them for ransom. And because of the strong tradition of Pidyon Shvuyim,
right.
What is that in English?
Redeeming the captive.
Right, thank you. Because of that strong tradition, Jewish communities all through the Mediterranean world, but especially the wealthier ones, like in Venice or in Livorno or whatever, would contribute regularly and ransom Jewish captives. And there was a large prison full of thousands of Jews in Malta who were ultimately ransomed and therefore seen as a valuable source of income.
Fascinating. We will talk more about Malta next week, and we'll talk about the mystical aspects of it too.
Sure, that too.
Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie is divorcing her husband, Moshe. The judge asks Sadie, "So, madam, how old are you?" Sadie says, "I'm 40 years old, Your Honor." The judge says, "Please answer my question truthfully, madam. How old are you?" Sadie repeats, "I'm 40 years old, Your Honor." The judge says, you're not being truthful. It states here you were born in August 1940. That means you are well over 80 years old. Sadie says, "But, Your Honor, I'm not counting the last 40 years with my husband." The judge says, "Why not?" Sadie says, "That you call living?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live, really live, and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Chaye Sarah, which marks a transition in the Genesis narrative from the tales of Abraham and Sarah, our first Jewish father and mother, towards the next generation, featuring Isaac and Rebekah. But first, we begin with an ending. At the start of the portion, we're told of the length of Sarah's life and almost by accident learn about Sarah's death. The life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years, the Seder begins, and the famous Midrash on it tells us Sarah was just as beautiful at the age of 100 as she was at 20, and just as free of sin at 20 as she had been at 7. It's a fine encomium for a significant figure who now passes from the scene. Chaya Sarah is filled with negotiations that have great influence on the future of the fledgling religion, someday known as Judaism. The first extended section is dedicated to arranging for Sarah's funeral. It involves Abraham purchasing the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron, first piece of real estate owned by our people in what will later become known as the Land of Israel. That cave becomes the burial place not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah, they eventually all find their final resting place in Hebron. In Chaye Sarah, the purchase of this land involves an extended bargaining session with the Hittite who owns it and the payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish place in the world, establishing Jewish legitimacy in the Middle East at an extremely early point in history. I personally have visited Machpelah twice, once many years ago when you could go into the cave itself, again just a few years ago when Jews were only permitted by the Israeli authorities to go into the area above the cave itself for fear of creating a violent incident. In any case, after Sarah's burial in Hebron, the narrative moves forward with one last important detailed episode of Abraham's life. Abraham's old. He sees his son Isaac is not yet married and perhaps seems unlikely to do so without parental intervention. He charges his trusted servant to go back to the old country of Sumeria, today's Iraq, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry and carry on the line of believers in the one true God. After a great journey and the first extended prayer recorded in the Torah, the servant meets Rebekah drawing water from the city well in Haran. He knows she is the one for Isaac because she shows generosity and intelligence. Abraham's servant too bargains, in this case, with Rebekah's duplicitous brother and father. Eventually, the servant arranges for her to become Isaac's wife. But at the crucial moment of the narrative, Rebekah's family puts a question to her. Will you go with this man? That is, will she leave all she's known and journey to an unknown land and future husband? This final negotiation of Chaye Sarah is brief. Rebekah agrees with alacrity. Yes, she will leave the homeland and her father's house and go to the land that will be shown her. Like Abraham before her, she goes to Canaan, meets Isaac, and the future of the people and monotheism is assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history: land, descendants, and destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have simply ceased. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rebekah and Abraham before her, our destiny would have been disappearance. As Jews, these remain principal goals today, and often they still require negotiation to achieve a secure land of Israel, our children's and grandchildren's Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. Aren't these worth negotiating for? When we come back, our guest, the terrific author and multiple past guest of Too Jewish, Dara Horn, explains why people are so fascinated with dead Jews today, and why they perhaps should instead explore living, vital Judaism. Find out when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our brothers. former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who served as the first black national security advisor, the first black chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the first black Secretary of State. Under Presidents Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush, died last week. Powell famously was raised in the Bronx, where he served local Jewish families as their Shabbos goy and became fluent in Yiddish. It's not clear how important Yiddish was in his later role as an American military and diplomatic leader, but until Anthony Blinken came along as Secretary of State under President Biden, it seems very likely that Colin Powell was the only one to hold that office who understood the Mamaloshen. He was a fine man and served our country faithfully. He had the unusual ability among American leaders of being honest about admitting his mistakes, even seeking a kind of tshuva. May his memory be a blessing, as ein neshama geitzum gan eden. In Texas, the controversy over the requirement to teach opposing points of view on complex historical issues somehow dragged the Holocaust into it, as opponents of the legal requirement claimed the law would obligate school districts to teach opposing points of view on the Holocaust. The media storm that resulted has had very little to do with the actual issues involved in teaching both sides of historical events and issues. For example, the full story of the Alamo or the consequences of slavery. But the response to that school board controversy in Southlake, Texas, has bounced through the Jewish world, striking painful sparks. Of course, there is no opposite side on the facts of the Shoah, and it's quite unlikely anyone will try to pretend that Holocaust deniers have a place in a school curriculum. But as we constantly re-examine and reinterpret history, I mean, we always have, we are going to change our views and wish to have them presented to students in a balanced way. None of that has anything to do with mandating counterfactual views of the Holocaust and that being taught in schools, which they will not be. This is a ginned-up controversy that distracts from the very real need to present complicated historical truths in an honest way. Sweden's foreign minister visited Israel last week, ending a 7-year freeze in diplomatic relations between the two former allies that started over disagreements on Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. Foreign Minister Ann Linde's visit opens a whole new book of friendship and cooperation, said her Israeli counterpart, Yair Lapid. Israeli President Isaac Herzog said this event symbolized the countries were turning over a new leaf. Sweden and Israel have a deep and long-standing friendship with extensive trade and cultural ties. There are also quite a few arguments. In recent years, those arguments caused us to drift apart. Today we are changing that, Lapid said at a press conference with Linde in Jerusalem. The visit came less than a week after Sweden's government hosted a high-powered international conference on combating anti-Semitism in Malmo, a city known in recent years for being a hotspot of violent anti-Semitism in Sweden. The moves signal outgoing Prime Minister of Sweden Stefan Löfven's desire to repair relationships with Sweden's local Jewish communities and the Jewish state. On behalf of Sweden, I promise that we say never again and mean it, Linda tweeted after a visit to Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust memorial and monument. We will continue to take action to combat anti-Semitism in all its forms to make sure that we never forget. Israel and Sweden ceased former relations back in 2014 after Sweden officially recognized the Palestinian state. Following year, after the multiple terrorist attacks in Paris that left 130 people dead, Sweden's then foreign minister, Margot Wallström, linked the killings to what she argued was a feeling of hopelessness among Palestinians. Wallström, a longtime outspoken supporter of a Palestinian state in 2016, called for an investigation into how Israeli security forces responded to Palestinian attackers during a spate of violence. In response, Lapid, then an opposition leader in Israel's parliament, called her anti-Semitic. Lapid, whose father and grandmother were among the tens of thousands of Jews saved by the Swedish diplomat Raoul Wallenberg during the Holocaust, welcomed Linda at a press conference in Jerusalem. He said, "In my parents' house, there is a wooden box in which my late father kept some souvenirs that survived the Holocaust. There is a yellow badge with the letter J, Jude, Jew, some photographs and letters that somehow survived the war. Lapid continued, and there's a Wallenberg passport, a document laden with seals and signatures designed to hide the fact that Raoul Wallenberg had virtually no authority to grant it to my father, but he did, and saved their lives. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
Introductory Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? What do Jews believe about life after death? Introductory Judaism with Rabbi Sam Kohan is an 8-month-long weekly class Sunday afternoons. It's available in person and on Zoom. To sign up, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. There is a charge for the class and the textbook, and scholarships are available. The Introductory Judaism class is open to everyone, Jewish or not. Want to refresh and update the Jewish learning you had before your bar mitzvah? Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Or maybe you're even thinking about becoming Jewish. Register for Introductory Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. Or you can visit BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or you can email rabbi at BeitSimchaTucson.org. Introductory Judaism is taught in person and by Zoom Sunday afternoons from October to May at Congregation Beit Simcha, 2270 West Einar Road, just west of La Jolla. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675.
We welcome back Dara Horn, the terrific author, novelist, and writer of the book People Love Dead Jews, Reports from a Haunted Present. Dara, we started talking in the first part of the show about how, you know, this was a book you didn't really want to write. You spent a lot of time writing about the vitality of contemporary Jewish life, about the vitality of Jewish life many years ago, the vitality of Jewish life throughout history, the vitality of Jewish eternal life even. And yet, why are people so fascinated by the Holocaust? Now it's 80 years past many of the events. And that's all they know about Judaism.
Yes. Well, people tell stories about dead Jews that make them feel better about themselves. It's very easy to talk and write about the Holocaust because all of us look great compared to the Nazis, right? I mean, that's like, you know, we can all get behind that. And, you know, that's, and what has happened, though, is that then the Holocaust has become something that people present as like this metaphor for the limits of civilization or something like that. But in order to do that, you have to erase living Jews. And that goes to where I started writing this book. I first started thinking about this idea in 2018 when Smithsonian Magazine asked me to write a piece for them about Anne Frank. And I just remember thinking, wow, I really don't want to write about Anne Frank.
Right.
But I'm, you know, I'm a writer, and I know from my work that, you know, the uncomfortable moments are often where the story is. So instead of just turning this assignment down, I thought, this is interesting. Why don't I want to write about this? And I remembered a news item I had seen about the Anne Frank Museum, which is, you know, this museum in Amsterdam where it's those tiny rooms where
her family were
hiding from the Nazis.
Sure.
And it's now like this blockbuster museum. They get 2 million visitors a year.
Yep.
There was a young Jewish man who worked at the museum in 2018, and the museum refused to let him wear his yarmulke to work. They made him hide it under a baseball hat.
Mm.
And he appealed this decision to the board of the museum, which then deliberated for 4 months and then finally relented and let him wear his yarmulke to work. And I had seen that news story, and I just thought, you know, 4 months is a really long time for the Anne Frank House to ponder whether or not it was a good idea to force a Jew into hiding. And then I realized, you know, this isn't, you know, it might be a PR mishap, but it's not a mistake. There's this requirement that living Jews erase themselves in order to make room for this, like, metaphor about humanity, and that, I feel, is really insidious and perverse. And so I did write that piece for Smithsonian, and then what happened was that piece came out in the fall of 2018, within a few days of that piece coming out was the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And then the New York Times called me and asked me to write about this. And, you know, as I put it in the book, I became the New York Times' go-to person for the emerging literary genre of synagogue shootings and their op-eds. And I just thought, you know, why do all of my mainstream editors at these publications only ask me to write about dead Jews? Why is this happening? And that's how I started diving into this topic with this book.
You know, I been doing this show for a long time. I finally cleaned out my office recently for the first time in 15 years. And part of it was removing and filing or putting in bookcases huge numbers of submissions. I would say 50% of the books and fiction and nonfiction that I've received over the years have to do with the Shoah, their personal memoirs, their Holocaust accounts, their novels about it, their poetry about the Holocaust. There's an obsession among Jews, and it's kind of a little too much, isn't it?
I mean, it's not even just that it's too much. This is a playing a role in a wider non-Jewish world's imagination. But I think it also is something that has happened in the Jewish community where, you know, when a lot, you know, in the past 30 years, we put up, there was a lot of, like, museums and things that were built, you know, to commemorate events in the Holocaust. There were, like, you know, mandatory school curricula and things like that. And, you know, the idea behind those when the Jewish community sort of, you know, tried to, you know, promote this 30 years ago was that Holocaust education would prevent anti-Semitism, right? The idea was that people would come to these museums or learn about this in school, learn what the world had done to the Jews, and they would then stop hating Jews. So, I mean, the thing is that, you know, 25 or 30 years later, you know, anti-Semitic, you know, rates of anti-Semitic incidents and hate crimes are much higher now than they were 25 or 30 years ago. So, you know, I think that, you know, while it wasn't a ridiculous idea, I think we can say it's been proven wrong. And, you know, this is sort of what's interesting to me is in the book I have a chapter about this Auschwitz Museum show that was in New York City. It was a traveling exhibit that had started in Spain. And the amazing, and it got enormous media coverage. It was like you said, it was this like saturation about this.
Yeah.
And what I thought was amazing about that, though, is very little of the coverage mentioned this. Most of those Holocaust museums from the past 30 years were made by, you know, Jewish philanthropists or nonprofit organizations. This exhibit was made by a for-profit European company whose business is blockbuster museum shows. Their most famous show from 15 years ago was a show called The Bodies Exhibit. It was, like, in major cities around the country. It was, like, you know, where they had, like, cadavers that were, like, colorfully dyed and posed. You know, and they had another show about the Titanic. As I put it in the book, you know, oh, of course this isn't a disaster porn company. This is an education company. Who could argue against education? I'm here to argue against education because I think what you see happening is this erasure of living Jews in order to turn this Holocaust into like a nice message about humanity. And that, and you see that in many, many ways in the erasure of contemporary Jewish life. And we could talk more about other ways in which that appears in the book too.
I think we should. You know, it's fascinating. I don't know why people love slasher films, but it seems to me it's the same motivation that brings people to a show like Auschwitz, as it did to the body exhibit, the same kind of thing. It's like, let's see something horrifying.
Well, perhaps, but it's also like, it's almost like a kind of moral pornography, because like I said, people tell stories that make them feel better about themselves.
Yeah.
We all look great compared to the Nazis.
Yeah, compared to the Nazis or compared to Jack the Ripper or,
yeah,
you know, take your pick. Let's talk a little bit more about the erasure of Jewish life, of contemporary Jewish life.
Yes.
I love and hate that story about the guy, the curator at the Amsterdam Museum for Anne Frank, who they debated 4 months before they decided whether he had to hide his yarmulke. That's just a piece of it, though. Tell us a little bit more about some of the other ways in which Jewish life's being erased.
Well, so there's another example of that in the same museum the year before in 2017. They had an audio guide display. You know, many big museums have these there where, you know, it
right.
has the
you
audio
walk
guide
around,
in many
you
languages.
Put stuff in
yeah,
those,
like
yeah.
English, and there's a British flag, and then it says French, and there's a French flag. Until you get to Hebrew, no flag. I mean, this is like, it's not subtle, like I said, and it might be a PR mishap, it's not a mistake, right? I mean, this is very unsubtle, very direct erasure of living Jews. You have the similar thing going on in, I think, the way that you see anti-Semitic attacks reported in the media. So one of the chapters in the book toward the end is about the attacks just before the pandemic on the Hasidic community in the area where I live. I live in New Jersey.
Right.
About 20 minutes from my house, there was a shooting at a kosher
yeah,
grocery store.
Horrible, right?
Yes. And there were many other attacks, but another one I write about is this machete attack in Muncie, New York.
Hanukkah,
it's an upstate New York
right.
town, yes.
Yep.
It's a town with a large Hasidic population. Somebody walked into a crowded Hanukkah party and started slashing people with a 4-foot machete. What I did was I looked through the news reports about those incidents, and it wasn't just those two. It was many, many others. And unfortunately, it didn't stop with the pandemic. I almost couldn't find a news article about one of those incidents that didn't say something derogatory about the community being attacked while reporting the attack. It would say, like, oh, you know, just for context, you know, this town where these Hasidic Jews live is, you know, there have been all these zoning battles between the Hasidic and non-Hasidic residents, or, you know, like, oh, there was a battle about the school board. And I'm thinking, you know, do we normally resolve municipal disputes with a machete? You know, or then with the one in Jersey City, they said, oh, you know, this Jewish community was gentrifying a minority neighborhood.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, like, these are highly visible members of the world's most, you know, most persecuted minority, number one. Number two, you know, is the rage against gentrification so great that people are walking into a blue bottle coffee and blowing away white hipsters? Because I haven't seen that reported. And I realize, you know, this kind of reporting is really just sending a signal to the public, telling people that these people who were attacked deserve it. That's all it is. And this is very, very old. I mean, if you think about, oh, their Hasidim are exerting their control over the town council, I mean, this is like the oldest, you know, the oldest anti-Semitic
trope
line
that there
in the
is.
Book of,
yeah,
like, oh, the Jews
course.
Are taking over and exerting too much power or something. I mean, it's just, it's so glaring. And so that's what I mean by the erasure of Jewish culture. Also, it's like, you know, what do you read about in a school textbook about Jews in an average American public school?
The Holocaust.
There's a chapter about the Holocaust.
Yep.
That's it. This is like the, you know, Jewish culture is the foundation of Western civilization and Christianity and Islam. It also is this, like, amazing counterculture that runs through the whole history of the West. Why is the only thing we're talking about is how these people were murdered, and that teaches us some kind of nice lesson about humanity?
It's an awful problem, right? And,
yeah.
And we struggle with it all the time, even when we don't think about it. And, you know, for a while, one of my first guests on Too Jewish was Leonard Dinnerstein, who wrote the book Anti-Semitism in America. And at the time, this is now a long time ago, Len, may rest in peace, said, you know, anti-Semitism is on the wane in America. There's so much less anti-Semitism now than there used to be. There's Jews in Congress, there's Jews in the Senate, Jews belong to all the same country clubs that used to exclude them, and so on. Lots of Jews in the Ivy League, which used to be very, very difficult with the quotas, but it's gone the opposite direction in the last 10 years. I think everybody understands that, I hope. Why?
Well, there's a couple of things to understand. One is that, you know, anti-Semitism is cyclical. You could say all those same things about, oh, look at all these Jews in prominent positions in the society, about, like, ancient Greece.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is not like a new, you know, this is not like, oh, look, we finally achieved this and now it's falling apart. That's not what's happening here. This is a cyclical pattern. But I also feel that there is a fatal flaw in the way that our society talks about diversity that makes this possible. I have an episode of my podcast, Adventures with Dead Jews, that I actually just recorded. I'm, you know, it will be be out by the time your listeners hear this. My seventh episode of this is about an old movie that came out in the 1940s, 1947, called The Gentleman's Agreement.
Yeah, Gentleman's Agreement. It's a great
film. It's Gregory Peck.
Gregory Peck as a Jew, by the way.
Yes. It's about, it's like an anti-Semitism movie. It's like teaching Americans how not to be bigots, basically. And what's amazing when you watch that movie now is, like, you see how it's like, the moral of that movie, which is very much baked into all, like, you know, the kind of anti-bias training and, you know, the kind of thing we teach kids in school, is like, Jews are just like everybody else, you know, and that's why you shouldn't hate them, because, you know, Jews are just like everybody else. Well, the problem with that is that Jews spent 3,000 years not being like everybody else, right? Like, uncoolness is basically Judaism's brand. Going back, like, 3,000 years, like, when we were the first people to worship a bossy and unsexy invisible God, right? Like, Jews have never wanted to be like everybody else. And that, I think, is what's so interesting, because if you were to really learn Jewish history as part of the history of Western civilization, you see this countercultural pattern. And it also, it sort of exposes a lot of flaws in the way we think about diversity, because, and this is, you know, a conversation we're having now in our country about, you know, the way we think about race, the way we think about American history. And I think there's a challenge here, which is diversity just, you know, collecting people from a lot of different backgrounds but who all think the same way? Or are we going to actually be curious about other people's history, belief, experiences, and culture? You know, that requires a lot more curiosity and empathy that most people are not willing to put into it.
And an openness to accepting that people can have different ideas and share them, which is a very Jewish way of thinking about things, right?
Yes. I mean, this is sort of the foundation of Jewish culture, is critical thinking. You know, the way I end the book is, I decided at the end of the book, after all these, you know, anti-Semitic attacks just before the pandemic, I made this commitment to study Talmud. And one of the things that you discover in studying Talmud is, like, there's never any conclusions, right?
Right.
I mean, it's just all these rabbis debating with each other. They're debating with somebody who died 100 years earlier. They're debating with somebody who's still alive sitting next to them at the table. But it's like, you know, it's just this ongoing open conversation. And, you know, and they always include all of the opinions, even the ones that don't end up being, you know, the consensus. And, you know, that, I think, is what is very much missing from American life now, especially when our country is so polarized. You know, we're living in so many silos, both online and in reality, too.
We just need to be more Jewish.
One could argue there's no such thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much, Dara. I appreciate that. That may show up as an intro for the show from now on. I want to thank Dara Horn for a great visit here on Too Jewish. I feel like we could go on for a long time. The book is terrific, and you should get it. It's called People Love Dead Jews, Reports from a Haunted Present. But I would say it's much more about, to me, kind of an inspiration for living Jews. Dara, thank you. Where can people go to find out more about you?
So I do have a website, darahorn.com, and it has a list of public events that I have. And I also would point your listeners toward my podcast, Adventures with Dead Jews, which you can subscribe to on any of the podcast platforms. And it's different. So if you've read the book already, it's different material than the book. They're sort of, they're two different projects, but on the same topic.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rachel Beanland, author of the excellent novel Florence Adler Swims Forever. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services at an Onig Shabbat, starting at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. for Torah study, 10 a.m. for services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, or join us online. Our play out this morning comes from the great klezmer clarinetist Giora Feidman, his version of a tune close to my heart because it's called Dancing with the Rabbi. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.